This is the Doubles Only Tennis Podcast, where you learn the best tips and strategies in the world to help you become a smarter, more effective tennis player. You'll hear interviews with Pro Tour doubles players and coaches, including easy-to-use lessons to improve your game and win more matches. My name is Will Bocek, founder of the Tennis Tribe, doubles strategy coach, and host of the show. You're about to hear a conversation between myself and Chase Bartlett. Now, you probably have not heard of Chase before. If you've been following the Tennis Tribe for a while, you may have. He was one of our original writers way back, probably 4, maybe even 5 years ago. And I met Chase in Austin, Texas, when he was playing Division II college tennis at St. Ed's University. After that, he transferred after his program at St. Ed's got shut down, which we talk a little bit about. He was actually on the Sports Illustrated podcast talking about that. And he transferred to Montana, where he played. Then he coached for a little bit. And then now he's starting a company called Bridgeable that connects players and coaches that you should definitely check out. And like I said, you probably haven't heard of Chase, but he's a name that I really think he's a really smart guy, and I think he's going to do big things in the tennis industry over the coming years. If you haven't heard of him yet, this is a kind of early access to somebody who I think is going to definitely make an impact. And in this conversation, we talk about coaching. What does it take to find a good coach? What does it take to be a good coach? He studied that a lot since founding Bridgeable. And we also talk about double strategy since he played at D2 and a D1 school. He knows a lot about doubles. The doubles point is very big in D2 and D1. And he actually shares a tactic that I have definitely never heard before. It's kind of a serve formation thing that I haven't tried yet, but I want to try soon. It's really wild. So you'll definitely want to listen to that part and maybe try it yourself. So without further delay, enjoy this wide-ranging conversation with Chase Bartlett. Hey everyone, welcome to the show. Today we have Chase Bartlett on, a former St. Ed's player, Montana Grizz player and coach, and also writer of the Tennis Tribe, one of our first writers from way back when. Chase, welcome.
Hey Will, thanks for having me.
So I'm excited to talk to you because you have a lot of experience in tennis from both a junior perspective, then college, and then you coached at Montana for a little bit. And then now you're starting this new project called Bridgeable that's going to connect players and coaches that everybody should check out. And we'll get into all that here shortly. But first, before I ask you about your college career, I wanted to talk a little bit about your podcast with John Wertheim. A couple years ago, I guess this was like summer 2020 after COVID, you had played for St. Ed's for like 3 or 4 years, right? And then they decided to shut down the program. A little bit about like what happened there, what was the result, and then how you got on the Sports Illustrated tennis podcast with John Wertheim.
Yeah, it's definitely a good story. I mean, so I was a senior in college. This is my fourth year. And I think when March rolled around, that's when things started shutting down because of COVID. I remember one day in April, our coach called like an urgent team meeting. And by this time, we hadn't seen each other for about a month. Mm-hmm. And the news was that the school was cutting our program, but they were also cutting like a ton of other programs. I think they cut 6 total, which was the most any school in the country cut, besides removing an entire athletic department. And so it was obviously really devastating because if any of the listeners are college tennis players or been on a college team, you know, it's really important. It's essentially like a family to us. And so it was pretty devastating. And we took some time to like kind of let that sink in. And we realized that like, you know, the school wasn't giving us really good answers about why these cuts had happened. They weren't being very transparent. And we started a relatively large movement to actually bring the programs back. Mm-hmm. The school was asking something ridiculous, like upwards of $20 million for all 6 programs to be brought back. And these long-term like endowments that were roughly equivalent to like 1/5 of the school's endowment itself just for athletics. So it's like, it was basically an extortion request. We got a change petition signed like 20,000 times, which is 6 times the student body at St. Ed's, which just shows you like how big of a movement we actually created. Mm-hmm. I wrote a couple like investigative journalistic pieces for the school newspaper. I was meeting with people on the board of directors at the university. I met with the president of the university a couple times. And it was just really, really shocking. Like when we dug into it, and I don't want to go into too much detail here, but at one point, John reached out to me and said, "Hey, I find your story really interesting. Love to have you on the Sports Illustrated podcast." So I hopped in, talked to him for a while. It was a good conversation. At that point, it was kind of becoming clear, even though we raised several hundred thousand dollars, that the school just wasn't going to work with us. And so, yeah, that was one interesting conversation that resulted out of that, though. I also spoke with a guy from Tennis Now. That's a big website. Mm-hmm. He wrote a long form feature on us. It was an interesting time for college tennis for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. It was an interesting time for the world. So to give people a little perspective, so John Wertheim, he's like on 60 Minutes. Like
he works for 60 Minutes now.
Yeah, he interviews people on 60 Minutes. So he is a huge deal. So for him to get a hold of this story and reach out to you is really amazing. And does St. Ed's have their tennis program back, or is it still cut as of right now?
Not yet. Unfortunately, it's still cut. Mm-hmm. The school did bring back soccer and cheer, I think. Which was, I guess, a step in the right direction. We got a new president, so there's new leadership. So she seems to be very athletic friendly. So that's a good thing.
Yeah. So I want to transition to your college career. So you played at St. Ed's for 4 years. Is that right?
Yeah, I played at St. Edward's University for 4 years, and then went to the University of Montana as a grad student. So I had one extra year from COVID of eligibility. Mm-hmm. So I went through the recruiting process again as a 22-year-old, which was super weird. it was not something I'd ever go through again if I had to, but found a school last minute, found an amazing coach there, a good family there. Which I consider myself really lucky. I think I might have found the best two college tennis coaches in the whole country. and I don't think many people have that experience. So that was nice. And then I went there, played a year, and coached a year after as well.
Okay. And that's in Missoula, is that right?
Yeah, that's in Missoula, Montana. Okay. It's just a couple hours south of Canada.
Okay. So that's a very similar climate to Austin, Texas, I assume, right? Because you wouldn't make a big change like that.
Yeah, no, I would never make a big change like that. No, it was freezing. I mean, we had some winters where I think we had one day in the winter where it was like -20 Fahrenheit. And I was like, if you go outside for longer than 5 minutes, you could die.
Gosh, did you ski or anything?
I was a little bit apprehensive.
I guess
about
you're playing
that,
college tennis, you don't want to get hurt. Yeah.
Yeah, the last thing you want to do is tear a knee. I don't think tear a knee.
Right.
Coach wouldn't be too happy with you. So
that's true. That just seems like such a vast shift from like Austin, Texas, a fast growing tech city and 100-degree heat to Missoula, Montana. Tiny, I don't think that's a tiny town, but it's not as big as Austin, I imagine.
it's like 70,000 people. Yeah,
it's super cold. So I was looking at your doubles record in college. So do you know these numbers?
I have no idea, but I'm not sure I want to know them.
Okay. So freshman year at St. Ed's, you were 16 and 17 in doubles. Then sophomore year, 13 and 10, then 12 and 5, then 7 and 0, and it got cut short, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then you transitioned to Montana, which St. Ed's is D2, right? And then Montana's D1.
Yep.
The competition's a little stiffer. And then you still get a winning record of 8-6. So it seems like you progressed. Every year your record was better until you went to D1. And then obviously the competition's tougher. Mm-hmm. So it seems like you got better and better each year as a doubles player. I wanted to ask, is there anything you remember specifically and in doubles or in college? I know doubles is not valued as highly. Y'all are playing one set. It's no ad, whereas singles is a full 2 out of 3. But is there anything that you changed about your game strategically from your freshman year all the way to your grad student year at Montana?
Yeah, a couple of things. But definitely college doubles is important. Like it's interesting, like you'd think it wouldn't be that important, saying it's only worth 1 point and right. There's, you know, it takes 4 points to win a match in D1. But we would have conversations with our team where, like, you know, it would basically be unspoken that if we got the doubles point, like, okay, we're probably going to win this match. If we don't, we've got to win 4 out of 6 singles, which is, that can be a tough task, even against a team that's not great, right? Like you could be better than a team, and winning four singles still might be a little bit tough. Right. So that is important for sure. And I think with regard to my record, I came in, I think I was playing one doubles as a freshman, which is why I was probably I was probably worse my freshman year. But over time, it definitely got better. We realized that as a team, we weren't practicing doubles enough, and it's just so important. So we started training more. We started doing more doubles drills in team practice. And then over time, you'd probably find this interesting. We found, we kind of started like messing around with this system that we called motion. Mm-hmm. And it was essentially where like you would play I formation, but the guy at the net would start right at the service line and like the T. Okay. Yeah. And so he would be in like a ducked position, kind of facing off towards one of the single sidelines, and he'd be crouched. Right. And he'd be looking at the server, and whenever the server would toss the ball, that's when the player from the service line would move out to a position that the coach had called. So it'd be like, you know, you could move I middle, you could move I left, you could move I right. Mm-hmm. You could play standard motion, you could play I motion, you could do all these different things. And what it would do is like, once the serving player had tossed the ball up, he doesn't see any of it. So it's not going to distract him serving, but you know, you're essentially moving while the other player is serving, and it's causing like, you know, it caused some serious like paranoia, I think, in the guys that we played. It was like,
yeah,
they're trying to focus on two things at once, and it could really get in the way. It's totally legal. I mean, it's not like it's some kind of unethical thing to do. Like people are faking normally in doubles all the time. Yeah. So,
that's interesting. So the first thing that comes to mind for me is like, let's say we're doing that and serving. I would think this would happen more often in the ad court. So if you're serving and I'm sitting on that tee and we're in the ad court, so am I facing the right singles line or the left singles line, or does it just depend?
I would say you're probably facing the right singles line on the ad court.
So I'm facing,
but you're kind of like looking over your shoulder to see whenever I toss the ball up, and then you move out. Yeah.
Okay. So if the coach called like me to run into a traditional formation, I have to do that and like stay kind of ducked a little bit. Otherwise I might get hit by the serve. If I'm like, is that something you're into?
No, it didn't really happen that often. It definitely does happen sometimes, but we got even more advanced with it. And it's been a couple of years since we've ran any of these plays. At my other team, we didn't play it at all, but we were essentially doing calls like football calls, you know, where you'd say like blue 42 set hut, you know, like, that play means something, right? So the coach could call, like, you know, our colors were like blue and gold. So he'd be like, hey, gold, 11, nickel. And it would be
so the other team's hearing this, but they just don't know.
The other team's hearing it, has no idea what it means. There's no way they can decode it either. Like, and what it would mean is like the color would determine whether it was like, it was motion or regular play. And then the type of coin, like nickel, dime, quarter, is where you serve in the box. And then the number, like odd or even, that's what it was. We were calling like 11 or 27. You could call whatever number you want, right? To make it ridiculous. But if it's odd or even, that determines whether you poach or not. And so it was really cool because like the coach can say, he can call the play without having to be on our court. He could be two courts over and be like, you know, it could be a deuce point, no ad. and he could call something very specific and the other team would have no idea. And they're like, you know, there's also this like ludicrous element to it. It's just like, what are these guys doing? They're like, they're running around, they're calling these weird plays.
So this is definitely something, a doubles tactic I've never heard before. So there's three things. So go over them again. What was the first thing?
Okay. So we had like a color.
So the color, determines.
The color was determining whether or not it was motion, I believe.
Okay.
So if we play normal, say we're just going like standard formation.
Okay. So you didn't get into this like I formation thing every time. That's what you're saying.
No.
Okay. I see.
He would call a play and it would basically decide whether.
And then second is the serve location. Right.
Yeah. That's the third thing. That's the quarter. So it'd be like the type of coin. So it'd be like quarter, dime or nickel. And that would be
T-body wide or
whatever. T-body wide. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And then last is, so if I'm in this like motion formation and you're serving to the ad court and he calls motion, body, and then poach, does that mean I run from that T to the deuce court? Is that what the poach means essentially? Just to go to the same side as the server? Okay. I see.
Yeah.
Interesting. That is, I've definitely never heard that before. For people listening, you know, give it a shot. I'm open to any and all ideas.
Maybe you'll have to put up a video so they can see exactly. I imagine it's probably hard to imagine.
I'm kind of
exactly
picturing
this
it
like.
In my head. And I would want to see it live. I'd imagine a lot of people listening, myself included, don't necessarily have the mobility of a D2 or D1 college athlete to be able to close into the net from that position as quickly. But that is fascinating. I want to get to a couple other questions. What was your favorite position on the doubles court? So we've got server, returner, server's partner, returner's partner.
Oh, definitely returner. I was pretty good at returning. I didn't have a great serve, but I definitely was one of the best returners on my team.
Okay. And what was your mindset or kind of strategy? How are you thinking about returning in doubles?
I mean, you want to get it past the net guy, especially at like the Division I level, unless it's a sitter. And then I would look to take a forehand and just crank it at the guy at the net.
Weak second serve, is that what you mean?
Yeah, a weak second serve. If I can step around and get a forehand, I was doing that pretty much every time. But I think the main strategy in doubles for me was like, if the guy's serving and volleying, you want to put that ball low cross court. If nobody's poaching, right? Like there's two pieces of information that are really important. One is the guy at the net poaching a lot? That'll determine your target. And depending on what stage of the match too, that's another bit of information to consider. And then the second is the guy serving and volleying. So if the guy's not serving and volleying, what you want to do is you want to get that return deep cross court. So that your partner, you would assume that he's up. If you're playing two back, it might be a little different. But if your partner is up at the net, standing around the service line, you get that return deep cross court. That's when he takes three steps in and can look to cut off the next ball. So you could even like, we even played return and volley strategies a lot where you're just like hit the return and come to the net.
So what about, did you lob off the return ever?
Quite frequently, yeah. It's a really good strategy. I think like a lot of players, even at the the top Division I level, but like even at like mid Division I level, players can still get tight about hitting overheads. It's kind of surprising. And you know, like the lob, especially like what players want to do, especially at the high level, is they want to close the net so they can put away the volleys. So their partner serves, they're going to get as close to the net. They're going to be practically touching the net at some points because they're really looking after that ball. And if you just put it up, a lot of times it'll go over their heads. Yeah. And that gives you, I mean, that's like one of the most reliable returns you can do is just a bunt over their head. That's something our teams did a lot.
Yeah. It's something really at every level it can be effective. And I see, I was talking with a recent podcast guest up in Montreal, Dave O'Hare. So he coaches Rajiv Ram and Joe Salisbury, who are the top team in the world right now. And they lob off the return a good bit. And it's something they actually practice. And like, of course they do. Like, it makes sense to me, but I had never thought about the fact that like someone would practice a lob return. Because like, at least at the club level, like most people listening to this have probably never practiced a lob return in their lives, unless they're playing like a practice match, you know?
I was going to say, if you didn't mention it, I was going to bring it up because we were practicing it quite a bit. Yeah. Actually, and it made a real difference. I mean,
yeah,
it's an important shot.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I would, I'm going to start practicing it myself. I've started using it more in just practice matches and it's improved, but, never really, I've never really had someone just serve to me and just practice lob returns. I think the most effective one is typically going to be that down the line one in the ad court against a righty. So they have a kind of high backhand overhead. I'm sorry, the deuce court. I think I said ad. But anyways, so you gave me a doubles tactic or kind of methodology that I'd never heard before. What was your favorite doubles drill in college?
I don't know. There's a bunch of good ones. I always like playing doubles drills. I would say like traditional two up, two back is a good one. There's some where you can play like one up, one back, and one person's feeding a ball as an approach shot and play out the point from there. And it kind of mimics, right? Like if you were to hit a serve and come in and hit that first volley deep.
Yeah.
We practiced hitting first volleys deep a lot at St. Edward's University. It was something that we got really good at. And Montana, it was interesting to hear like a different philosophy. So I know a lot of coaches who will say like, you've got to get your first volley deep and that's how you close. And that ball comes up as a result. Then I've heard other coaches, like the coach I had in Montana was, we had conversations about hitting that first volley short. So the person has to move forward and it's low and they actually still have to bring it up. And now they're out of position. So there's two different philosophies. I think like it actually depends a lot on the altitude, which is something probably a lot of listeners won't consider either. But in Montana, when you're playing indoors at altitude, you don't want to like get a lot of air on the volley because it's going to fly long. So like volleying deep isn't as effective actually as trying to hit like a shorter kind of bunt volley. Yeah.
Yeah. What was I going to say? The podcast episode I had with Will Hamilton. So he had Martina Navratilova on and she helped him with this doubles playbook where they do a bunch of videos and lessons for club players. And she liked to volley short a lot of the time. And she called it like the newt volley. I'm not sure why. It was like N-E-W-T. And the theory is like, especially today, there's so many people who are much more comfortable from the back of the court. And I would imagine this is even more frequent, like in college, right? When I go watch like a TCU match here in Fort Worth or whoever it may be, a lot of players have trouble getting forward and they don't like to get to the net as much. So they're so comfortable just ripping ground strokes from the baseline. So leaving that volley a little bit shorter can definitely be effective, but I would say it definitely depends on the opponent and then also altitude and what you're more comfortable with and so on. And variety, of course, is good as well. So
for sure. I remember reading about her take on that.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's dive into Bridgeable. So tell us, so Bridgeable, for people who want to check it out, you can go to bridgeable.com. We'll link to it in the show notes. But you're connecting players and coaches online. I love this because I've talked about it a lot on the podcast, not enough people use video to improve their game. And this is a way that like forces you to use video because you're working with a coach remotely. And then B, tennis is just kind of behind on using technology and video, and this is helping integrate that. But tell us how this idea came about, how it got started, and where you are today.
Yeah, for sure. So when I was in Montana, I mentioned that I was coaching for a year once. While I was there, I was getting my master's in business and had this, what we called like a venture launch class, where in 3 days we came up with an idea for a business. And at the end of it, our instructor was like, man, you guys should really pursue this. And that was Bridgeable. We came up with this idea that would essentially allow players and coaches to connect for remote instruction so that anybody could access the coaching that they need to get better, the personalized coaching they need to get better, anywhere and anytime. So in Montana, there's not really a huge tennis community. There's, I mean, it's cold for a lot of the year, so there's not too many, too many courts, but there's also not a lot of good coaches. I would say there's maybe a handful of great coaches there. And so what the problem is, that lots of players can't access the coaching that they need to get better.
Right.
They'll go and like, you know, of course, a beginner will watch YouTube to get started, and that'll be really helpful for them to understand how to hold the racket. And, you know, even up until they're maybe like an intermediate level player, like 2.5 or 3.0 or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, YouTube videos will help them get there. But eventually you'll reach this point where you plateau, and that's because you need personalized advice. It's not, you've played so much that you're reaching this intermediate level, and it's just not going to be, what you need to get to the next level without some kind of personalized instruction that's tailored to your specific problems and needs. And that's really where we come in, is we help you access great coaching from your fingertips, so that if you wanted to send a video for technical advice, have a match, an entire match reviewed by a coach, connect with an expert for a live conversation, or get drills and practice plans tailored to your game, we can essentially provide a full stop coaching service without the coach having to be there for you. And that's the dream behind Bridgeable, is like that players could get access to the coaches that I had growing up, that not a lot of people, like my parents paid to essentially move cities when I was 14 years old so that I could pursue my dream of playing collegiate or professional tennis. And we went to the best academy and spent a lot of money. And the sad truth is that not everybody can afford that, but there's a lot of people who want that kind of experience.
Yeah.
And so for me, this is the attempt to sort of bridge that gap, create a bridge between players and pros, and hopefully make the tennis coaching community more inclusive in the process.
Yeah. Yeah. A few things came to mind for me when you were just talking about that. So one is like just access. So there's so many people in, maybe you live in like a smaller town or something, or a place like Montana, like you said, where you're super into tennis, but there's just not a lot of good coaching around, or maybe not the type of coaching that you need. And then the other thing is, I do think tennis at some point, I think we're maybe like starting to move in this direction, but the way I've always looked at this and like heard about tennis coaches is like, you ask someone what they do and it's like, oh, I'm a tennis coach. Well, there's a lot of different aspects to tennis coaching, right? And like, as I've become more of like a double strategy guru, like that's the thing that I do. And if somebody comes to me and says like, hey, I need help making my serve more powerful, I'm like, okay, I can't do that, but I know some coaches who can, you know? So
exactly,
each coach can like kind of niche down into like, I'm really good with technique, or I'm really good with double strategy, or I'm really good with fitness or single strategy or whatever it may be. And you can find this, you know, if Bridgeable can get these coaches and players together, that seems a great way to personalize it, like you said, because some people listening, and I've talked about this before, and hopefully have helped some people kind of figure out what is their limiting factor to getting to that next level. And for some people, it might be technique. For some people, it might be strategy. For some people, it might be mental, physical, whatever. But regardless, you can kind of use this to find the specific coach for your needs.
Absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't have said it better. I mean, part of what we do is the access, right? But the extra level is finding the coach that's perfect for you. Right, like you're going to have unique problems. No player is the same. We all struggle with similar things, but nobody's going to, you know, have the same budget, have the same goals, have the same practice schedule. All this stuff that would determine which coach you choose ultimately, right? And in a marketplace, right? Like, say you lived in Austin, like if you wanted to go about finding the perfect coach for you, you would have to consider joining a club. You would have to evaluate, you know, all these other different factors, and maybe find one that works for you and try it out. The nice thing about what we do is, like, you know, our coaching profiles are pretty descriptive, and the fact that you can really understand exactly what this coach's experience is, what their strengths are, how they can help you, and whether or not that fits in your budget, and if it's the perfect coach or not. So that's definitely something that's nice about what we're doing.
Yeah, it's super important. And I know we have a lot of listeners in Austin, because that's where the Tennis Tribe started, and that's where I used to live. And I, you know, seeing a lot of league and club players, and even just going to like Austin High or something and watching people hit while I wait for a court, there's just so many, and I assume it's from some of the coaches in Austin. I don't know names or anything, but I see so many flawed, you know, forehands or serves, or people using the wrong grips and things like that. And I would love, you know, I do see one day tennis getting to a point where, like, there's kind of a standard methodology for a lot of this, especially technical work, in terms of playing tennis. But
sure. Yeah.
Anyways, how can people sign up for Bridgeable, start using it? We'll include all the links in the show notes, but tell people how they can sign up and kind of get the most out of it.
Yeah, so I would head to our website, which is bridgeable.com, and that's like B-R-I-D-G-I-B-L-E. It's not the traditional spelling. It's kind of like Lyft, like we had to go with like the startup name for sure. Okay. But yeah, I would head there and check it out. We have a bunch of coaches listed already. We launched about a month ago. Since then, we have around 15 coaches who've created full profiles, including some Davis Cup coaches, I think, which have signed up. Or if they haven't made their profiles yet, they've already signed up and are just finishing that right now. So you can get a healthy range from high school coaches all the way to elite coaches out there. If you have questions on, like, you know, what would be the right coach for me, we're building in this sort of algorithm that would kind of help you answer some questions and get paired with one. In the meantime, I wouldn't hesitate to reach out to me directly at chase@bridgeable.com. That's my email. And I can, you know, I would be happy to meet with anybody who's interested in getting better, might have some specific problems and really wants to try something new out, new and exciting, and see if it's what gets them to the next level.
Awesome. Yeah. And for everybody listening, you know, if you are in Austin and want to meet Chase, reach out to him. I'm sure he'd be happy to grab some coffee with you and talk about tennis and your game and things like that. And the coaches here, yeah, I mean, they are getting specific. I'm going to create my own profile here. I see we talked a little bit earlier about Sterling Strother, who I know, and he's, you know, if anybody's listening and needs help creating kind of a practice plan, he's a fantastic coach for coming up with drills. Even if you're just hitting with a partner, he's a great coach for that. And there's a lot of other good ones on here as well. So let's close out, Chase, with a couple of kind of rapid fire questions. What is your favorite pro tournament?
Pro tournament, Indian Wells. I think it's an awesome tournament.
Have you been?
I've always wanted to go, never been. And okay. I think our women's team one year got to go and meet Rafa, and all the guys were like, are you kidding me?
Oh man, jealous. Yeah. Definitely go. I went last October and then again this year, and I think it's going to be an annual trip for me. It's my favorite tournament that I've been to, aside from maybe the Australian Open, but that's kind of tough to compare. What is your favorite tennis book?
Tennis book. I'm not reading too many tennis books right now. I've got one on my shelf called The Little Book of Talent that actually informs a little bit about what we're going to be doing with Bridgeable in the future, how to learn things quickly, right? I mean, our goal long-term is to create a platform that would essentially allow everybody to access good coaching that's not super expensive. And a lot of that means providing ways for people to access information and get better quickly through a process. And so The Little Book of Talent was written by a guy named Daniel Coyle. And what he did is he just went and look, he wrote down like 52 short tips. It's a really small book about, you know, what it takes to get better, how your brain actually learns new things. And so that's kind of what I like to read, you know, to help me inform a better product for tennis players and coaches tomorrow.
Awesome. Yeah, that name sounds familiar. I think does he have like a TED Talk or something?
He's definitely done a couple of big talks. Yeah, he's a famous author for sure.
Okay. Yeah, I feel like I've read something of his. Okay, what's your favorite non-tennis book?
Non-tennis book. I just read one called The Craving Mind by Judson Brewer, I think. It's pretty interesting. It goes into like the psychology and the neuroscience behind why we crave certain things and what we can do to sort of get out of those habits using meditative techniques. They kind of proved from a scientific perspective that you could use meditative techniques to, you know, improve addiction better than the actual addiction techniques that were being used at that time, which is pretty crazy. So that was a great book. I'd recommend it to anybody.
Cool. Yeah, we'll link to both of those in the show notes. And last question for you. How can we make pro doubles more popular?
Oof, that is a great question. I wish pro doubles was more popular. I wish I could watch more pro doubles on TV. I don't know. I think that it's one of those questions that probably has to do with the sport itself. You know, I think a lot of people find doubles very interesting. But I wonder if, you know, the format of tennis, the way it's streamed, the way it's broadcasted, is maybe a little bit not exciting. Like the format, the way that we score things, you know, I think it's the UTS, Universal Tennis Showdown, kind of changed things up for a bit there.
Oh, yeah, that was.
That was kind of interesting. I also, you know, think that if college doubles was streamed more often, or college tennis in general was streamed more often, that people would find that pretty interesting because the level is pretty high.
Yeah.
Especially at a lot of Division I schools, you get some
sure.
really exciting players. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's my thoughts on it, but I wish I had a better answer.
No. Yeah. It's a tough question. And I think, we definitely need to be more innovative. I love the college answer because the team aspect has kind of proven to be successful, with the Labor Cup the last like 3 to 5 years, getting bigger and bigger. And then college tennis is kind of the ultimate team format. So it is getting more and more popular. And then later this year, they're doing an event. I think it's called the All-American Cup. I just found out about down in San Antonio.
I heard about
the Bryan brothers. Yeah, the Bryan brothers are creating like an East versus West, and it's all the top American men's teams. And it's all in San Antonio too. So it's, I'm gonna try to make it down for that. That looks like a lot of fun.
When is it?
I think it's in November, like 11th through 14th.
Okay, nice.
It's probably like during the ATP finals, because I don't think any of the American men are making that this year, unfortunately.
Strategically placed during the biggest term of the year.
It might be right after. I'm not positive, but it looks like a lot of fun. So,
gotcha. Nice.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Chase, for coming on. And thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thanks, Will. I enjoyed it.
If you're a doubles player, you'll love our weekly strategy newsletter. Every Thursday, I send you my best doubles tips, tactics, and strategies that you can use in your very next match. And when you sign up, I'll also send you a free 20-page ebook that has my favorite doubles tactics for forcing errors and getting more easy volleys at the net. Go to thetennistribe.com/newsletter to sign up now.